This is Art Moves. Art Moves is a series of curated conversations at the intersection of art, innovation, and social justice.
Each week, we'll be talking with the innovative thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts or redefining what it means to be creative.
I'm Tony Williams.
And I'm Eli Koslansky.
And we're your host for Art Moves. We are really pleased to have Tommy Safian. Now, he is the founder and managing director of Opportunity Justice. But I met Tommy a few years ago at a space in the Brooklyn Navy Yard called ReFoundry. It was a moment that I've never forgotten. I've never forgotten the work that you were doing. Share with our listeners what that was.
Well, I co-founded ReFoundry in 2015 and ran it for a while. And the concept was to train formerly incarcerated people to repurpose discarded materials into home furnishings, and then use that entrepreneurial experience to help them create their own businesses or career track jobs. And we used discarded materials because a lot of the participants we had, in their own words, felt discarded from society. And then when they use their own hands, their own industry, creativity to produce something of value, it had a special resonance for them. And when they then went out into flea markets and other venues to sell that, people would really approach them instead of as, and we hate this language, but as ex-cons
or
felons.
Yeah, we do hate this language, right?
And,
right,
you know, turn their backs on them. They would approach them as craftspeople and reach out their hands to them. And it just built a kind of esteem and acceptance and value that they hadn't had that opportunity to experience.
I can imagine it has a very transformative effect in a way, because it's a way to do something tangible with your hands, immediate feedback, and for which you have agency in. You know, so it's something you're controlling.
Yeah, I mean, one of the great things about craft is that, one, I think that it's just an essential human trait. It's universal. It's how we got, you know, craft, industry, and purpose is how we got from banging a stick on the ground to where we are today in a relatively short amount of time. And when you give people access to that creativity and to that craft, that's something that nobody can take away from them. They can take it with them wherever they go.
It's a real investment in self. And I think what I found most amazing was how artistic some of the work was. I won't forget looking at this circular coffee table. I'm still thinking about it today. It's like, well, I should have gotten that coffee table. But it was just amazing. Now, you're talking about craft. Our show is about art, but I've always seen craft as art. What's your feelings about that? And I'm going to also ask you that same thing, Eli, because you are also an artist. But when it comes to craft, art, and artisans, is there a distinction?
Well, I'm not sure that I have the bona fides to properly answer that question.
It's like one of those questions, right?
But I can give you my opinion.
Okay, right, that's what we want.
And my perspective in the work that I do. And I feel that craft is just applied creativity with your hand. It's an outlet that anybody can do craft if they practice it. Artisanship is doing craft, you know, for 10 years or more, like where you really get to a point of expertise and knowledge that is very distinctive in whatever it is you're doing. And I look at art as something that just some people have and some people don't. It's at the same time, like, everybody can make something artistic. You know, my child scribbles something on a piece of paper and I think it's beautiful and get a lot out of it. Whereas I can go to the museum and see a painting that's just a, you know, a white canvas, and I'm like, I'm doing all the work there. So it's it really depends on your perspective. But I think everybody certainly has craft and artistic sensibilities. Artisanship, I think, is much more difficult to develop and cultivate.
Yeah, it's a tricky question. I mean, I know I'm sitting here thinking, okay, how the hell you explain this? But, you know, in some ways, it's a dance, right? So there could be craft and art because, you know, you have to master something invariably, but not necessarily so. There's things that are actually poorly made. It's great art. So is that craft or not? Usually craft usually has a purpose. So art does not. Art is more of a snapshot or perception, a philosophy of a period or time or a motive state of the person who's creative it. So I guess that's the best way to describe that.
Yeah, that's what I meant to say. Yeah.
But, you know, the interesting thing about the white canvas, because there is a bunch of people who do the white canvas, is that does shift your perception of what art is to a certain extent.
Yeah. And I mean, like, I love, like, Duchamp's urinal as changing perception of what art is. So, again, you're right. It's in the moment. It's a mastery and
I guess also like anything, too, to really get appreciated. And look, there's a lot of stuff out there that's total crap, so let's be honest. But the other side of the coin is that, you know, like anything, to really appreciate it, and be it art, wine, anything, it takes work. So I think that's the other aspect of it.
Yeah.
So
and
hope I did well on the test.
Yeah, you did. Okay, you did. You know, I'm wondering, was there something, some moment underneath that inspired you to take your furniture making ability and then to share this to help people to just change their lives or transform their lives?
It's a good question. I think there were really two event influences on me. The first that I'll share to give context is I was, you know, I've been a serial small business entrepreneur in furniture for a long time. And I was brought in by a reentry organization that was interested in doing a social enterprise in furniture. And I really, at the time, didn't even know what a reentry organization was. But during that experience and learning about it and seeing how success was defined for the people they were serving, and the amount of human and financial resources going into it, that in the private sector where I came from, nobody would ever invest in that system. Mm-hmm. Nobody.
Interesting.
And it just seemed like there was better ways, different ways to approach this. So that was kind of on a practical level. A more of an emotional level, my cousin, who was my age, we grew up together, and when we were 21, he was murdered. And the person who killed him was caught and incarcerated, and every time the person was up for parole, usually someone from our family would attend. And one year, my uncle, who suffered the biggest loss, it was his son, went. And after the parole hearing, it was clear the guy wasn't going to get out at that time. My uncle broke all the rules, and he went out from behind his table and approached the man who had killed his son and shook his hand and said, "I hope one day you get out of here. And you can be a good parent to your children and a contributing member to your community." We hear a lot since I've gotten into criminal justice about forgiveness, and this was not about forgiveness. My uncle never forgave that person, and I don't ever forgive that person. But my uncle said, that's a tragedy, but it's our personal tragedy. And what he was telling us, I think, was, you know, if you lock people away and throw away the key, whether they sold a joint on the corner or killed somebody, they become burdens to society and dependents, and society doesn't work that way. Everybody has the obligation and the ability to contribute.
You know, though, what I find interesting about what you said is perhaps you haven't forgiven, but you have acted as though you have. You know, everything that you've done has shown a level of forgiveness. So
well,
it's just interesting.
Because the relationships that are important are the interpersonal relationships. And when the people who I work with who have been incarcerated, I'm looking at them and dealing with them as they are today, not the worst mistake that they made in their lives that got them into a situation of incarceration. That event in our lives was tragic, but it was our tragedy. It's not society's tragedy. And we have to deal with that, and everybody deals with that in a different way. I don't have a measure of forgiveness for that, and it's not my job, honestly, to forgive people or not forgive them coming home from prison. They've served their time. They've fulfilled that responsibility. And I don't think it's my place or society's place to forgive or not forgive people.
Well, I think there's two different things, because there's forgiveness and I think there's also the possibility of redemption, which I think what your uncle's talking.
Well,
no,
that's interesting.
I don't, again, like, there's a lot of language in criminal justice that I have a problem with, and redemption is one of them. And the reason why is because redemption is something you get from above, from someplace outside of yourself. And I think people have the ability to – and the opportunities to self-empower and to demonstrate their value to demonstrate their value in self-assertive ways versus having it bestowed upon them.
Yeah, no, I'm not talking about redemption right. in the classical religious
okay,
sense.
Sure,
I'm talking
yeah.
about self-redemption.
Right.
Right, personal redemption or self-redemption.
Well, I think my uncle in that, you know, just to continue, is an interesting conversation for me, is I think my uncle was more looking at his this person's obligation, and it's an obligation we all share. It doesn't matter if you're been incarcerated or what you've done, what your position in life is. I mean, life isn't fair. We're all you know, people have advantages and that others don't all over the place to greater and lesser degrees, but we all still share some of the same obligations.
Absolutely.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. We're talking to Tommy Safian, founder of Opportunity Justice. So that begs the question then, you know, there was some connection or leap from what you were doing from that previous program with furniture, and now you have this new organization called Opportunity Justice, because you talk a little bit not only just about the Opportunity Justice as an organization, but also as a concept.
Yeah, I think that you know, when we talk about giving people a second chance, that is another example of how language kind of dictates our perceptions and possibilities and also limits others. So second chance is this concept that businesses are embracing, that, you know, for people coming home from prison to give them a second chance by, you know, hiring them, giving them a job, you know, or at least interviewing them for a job. And the problem that I have with second chance is that, I grew up, my grandfather came over from Poland. He arrived in the United States by himself. He didn't have a penny in his pocket, didn't know anybody, didn't speak a word of English, and he built a middle-class life. And my father was the first Safian ever to go to college. And when I was a child, I knew that that was the pathway ahead of me, and that pathway was lined with avenues and stations, clear and accessible support. So I didn't get any chances growing up. I got opportunity. And so why do people of means, mostly white, get opportunity, where people who are coming home from prison, for example, mostly people of color get a chance. And the difference between chance and opportunity is monumental. And it that kind of language forms our expectations, our perceptions of, you know, our entire society, and in particular, people coming home from prison. So opportunity justice is really about bringing opportunity, not chances, to this community, and really focusing on economic justice and inclusion as much as criminal justice, because I do feel that mass incarceration is not the problem. Mass incarceration is a symptom that reinforces and underscores the underlying problem, which is a lack of opportunity in the relatively few communities that provide the overwhelming majority of our incarcerated population.
You know, I just have to, you know, I'm just loving everything you're saying and the intentionality around your words. So important, so very important. Now, we did speak about, or you know, because we've spoken to each other many times. Yeah. So listeners, when I say we spoke about, I'm talking to other conversations I've had with Tommy. Spatial justice program. Mm. Talk to us about that and this whole confinement piece that goes with that. I think our listeners would find that quite interesting.
Sure. So thank you for that. So the Spatial Justice Project is something that I just proposed as an idea late last summer, and it wasn't expecting it to get the kind of traction it did. But the idea around the Spatial Justice Project is public exhibits during the Jewish holiday of Sukkot. And Sukkot is commemorates the structures that the temporary structures that the Jews built while they after they were freed from slavery and wandering in the wilderness for 40 years in search of their home, and they represent freedom from oppression, community, and bounty. That's where people gathered for food, and they're three-sided. They would invite other people in, and they're festooned with greenery. And to set that structure next to what we're calling a confinement sukkah, which is a replication of a solitary confinement cell. And to instead of that being open, it's solid, thick, closed. It's instead not being festooned with greenery, it's festooned with barbed wire. It's not four-sided and open. It's enclosed. And it's trying to invite people in a public space from all different parts of our society, people who are just walking by, to come in and to see this juxtaposition and to experience it and to begin to have conversations about spaces that we have in our culture and in our society, and how those spaces, parks, schools, all sorts of structures, how they express our collective view of inclusion and justice. And I think that I felt that that juxtaposition of the Sukkot and the solitary confinement sukkah really was a visceral representation about the project is really not about solitary confinement in and of itself. It's really about that greater consideration of how we design and use spaces. Who do we design them for? Who's included? Who's excluded?
On your site, you have a video by Eric Gonzalez, who's the current Brooklyn DA. Mm-hmm. He talks about the Spatial Justice Program and how spaces shape our social relationships, and also how isolation is trauma-inducing. But, you know, I guess it's always a balance between, I mean, if you were more conservative, you would say, well, the point of this is to punish them, and, you know, it should be trauma-inducing. Mm-hmm. And there's other people say, well, then does that benefits society by having prisons like that? Or, you know, can you comment a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, it's a great question. Actually, I'm writing a series of opinion pieces for a publication called City and State. And the first piece that I wrote for them was exactly about what you're talking about in terms of what we mean by American justice. We don't really have a criminal justice system because there are all these disparate views about what justice and public safety mean to different people. And as you said, some people feel that prison should be punitive and as humiliating and used as a punishment and a deterrent. And some people feel that it's maybe a necessary removal of someone's freedom, but should be used to help best prepare them to come back and reintegrate into society. And the way we do design prisons, as D.A. Gonzalez pointed out, was for them to be more damaged and less able to integrate after that experience. And that doesn't serve anybody's purpose or benefit.
Are there architects who are designing, are there people who are designing those types of prison that you imagine? Or?
Well, you know, I'm not an architect or designer, but there are countries, Germany, Norway, Sweden, for example, that have very different prison designs. And this is what D.A. Gonzalez talks about in some of these videos that are featured on the Opportunity Justice website. And in those they're much more open, communal. They're not as stark. And in those countries, the recidivism rates are much lower.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM.
And we're speaking to Tommy Safian. He is the founder and managing director of Opportunity Justice. But anyway, it's so interesting how we do things to one another, not understanding any of the ramifications. I mean, we have a system that thinks, you know, punishing people doesn't have some sort of socio-emotional impact. That it's like we're doing the exact opposite of what we want to do because we're not looking at the problems deeply enough. But I wanted to go back to something you said, which had to do with how we should be speaking about those who are impacted by the criminal justice system. How would you suggest we speak about people?
Honestly, just the way you spoke to them, about them, as people.
Right.
They're people just like everybody else. We're humans. We're grossly infallible, and we all make terrible mistakes of judgment and action. And some people do that in a way that, you know, our society has determined to they have to be removed from society for some period of time, and their freedom is taken away. That's pretty harsh judgment. But they're still people. They're still members of our society. They're still parents and husbands and wives and children. And they still have value. Everybody has, you know, has value. I mean, one of the things that we try and I'm trying to instill in Opportunity Justice is giving people the opportunity to demonstrate that value when they come out. And even if they unfortunately go back for whatever reason, they can still have demonstrate that value and have import and impact that's positive no matter where they are, whether that's in prison or elsewhere, because prison is a community.
Absolutely. Now, I want to talk a little bit more about Opportunity Justice, and you provide consulting services. Share with us what does that look like and who the clients that you're currently working with?
So the consulting services that, you know, I gravitate towards is helping groups or entities or individuals really understand what their passions are, what their purpose is, and then figuring out a way to get them to where they want to go. And so to give you a couple of examples, one, I'm working with a tribal nation in South Carolina, North Carolina called the Catawba. And for people who aren't familiar, tribal nations have worse incarceration rates, family disruption, addiction and substance abuse rates, higher unemployment, lower income than the worst communities in the rest of the country. And they don't really the exclusion there and the kind of ingrained historical prejudice is very palpable and day-to-day and real. So I'm helping this particular tribal nation develop a 5-year economic development plan that can create small businesses and jobs and opportunities for their citizens, but that are based on their traditional crafts and practices, so that it's not coming in and telling them what to do and how to do it. It's taking what they already do and the value they already have and working with them to leverage that into what they feel they need.
And this is not a new formula, right? I mean, because I think about, I spend a lot of time in Arizona and, you know, I see what happens with the Navajo Nation. Mm-hmm. And the work that they do and the fantastic work they do in jewelry, which might be considered a craft, but mm-hmm. I see it as an art, mm-hmm. you know. But yeah, so I certainly understand what you're speaking about. You're doing a number of projects, though. And I think in my research of you, you've got some programs called Show of Hands, mm-hmm. Cords That Bind, the Justice Cafe. Why don't you share with us what those programs are?
Okay, thank you for that. I do want to clarify that I just started Opportunity Justice. It's only about 7 or 8 months old. So these are projects in development. But
certainly.
So they're conceptual now.
They're coming.
I have partners for them.
You're manifesting.
But it takes time.
So in some ways, it sounds like these programs are designed for social impact in some ways. Would you say that's accurate? Or?
Yeah. All of the projects that we do are driven by their potential for social impact. Give a starving person a fish and they're starving the next day. Teach them how to fish and they can feed themselves. And that's only half the equation. To extend that metaphor, let's take those same people and teach them how to fish using their creativity and industry and purpose and the resources around them for more than they need, and to sell that extra fish. And then with those proceeds, they can buy another rod or another net or another boat. That's how jobs and wealth are built in communities. And when communities have those resources, they know how to use them much better than someone coming from across the city or across the state or across the country and telling them what to do and how to do it.
I think what you said was a great place to wrap, and it was a treasure. That was a treasure, because that's the difference. That's what's going to create the kind of economy and the equity and the inclusion that we all say, or many of us say, we need. So, Tommy, thank you so much for joining us. It's been such a pleasure listening to you, and hope to have you back to talk more. Let us know what you need from us. Let our listeners know what you need from them.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Please go to opportunityjustice.com and check in periodically, because we're always doing new projects. And I would love the opportunity to come back and share as projects get off the ground and going, and invite you guys to do a show at the Justice Cafe when it opens.
Art Moves is co-produced by Brick Arts Media and pre-recorded at Brick Studio in downtown Brooklyn.
This has been Art Moves with your hosts, Tony Williams and Eli Kuslansky. Find some art that moves you and share it with someone.